Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special interview edition of the Empire Podcast. Oliver Stone's JFK is one of my favourite films of all time. And whether or not you buy into the case constructed by Stone in that movie, that President John F. Kennedy was not killed by Lee Harvey Oswald on November 22nd, 1963, but instead by a multifaceted conspiracy involving a number of interested parties, including disgruntled CIA officials, the mob, and high-ranking government figures, we can hopefully agree that it is a scintillating and epic slice of storytelling which marked something of a sea change for Stone in how he operated as a filmmaker. Unusually for such a dense, talky, and controversial movie, and perhaps because of the all-star A-list cast that Stone assembled, including Kevin Costner, Sissy Spacek, Tommy Lee Jones, Jack Lemmon, Joe Pesci, Kevin Bacon, John Candy, Walter Matthau, Michael Rooker, Gary Oldman, Laurie Metcalf, and of course, Wayne Knight, it did exceptionally well at the box office when it was released in 1991, grossing $70 million domestic, and it was nominated for 8 Oscars, winning 2. Its progressive way of presenting dense reams of information is hugely influential to this day. Stone's career since then has fluctuated somewhat, and when I caught up with him earlier this week on Zoom, it was interesting to hear him attribute that, to some extent at least, to the impact of JFK, but we'll get to that soon enough. The reason Stone and I were chatting again on Zoom, so bear in mind there will be a bit of audio ducking here and there, was because he has returned to the directorial fray with JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, a documentary about the JFK assassination in which Stone further develops his theories about cover-ups and conspiracies, aided by new information brought to light by the declassification of thousands of previously redacted documents that originally had been set to be unveiled, as per the Warren Commission, in 2029. But, and here's a positive aspect of the impact of JFK, the hubbub created by the movie in 1991 partially contributed to the implementation of the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992. Now, the documentary is very much in the style of JFK, the movie, with a fast-paced editing style, lots of footage in different stocks, and the voice of Donald Sutherland, who is one of the two narrators, along with Whoopi Goldberg. Stone himself also makes an appearance on mic and on camera, and it is compelling stuff. It is out now in UK cinemas, and I would highly recommend it if you are a fan of JFK, the movie, or JFK, the person, or if you have a passing curiosity at all about what might have happened to Kennedy on that fateful day in Dallas, Texas, or if you're an Oliver Stone completist. What you're about to hear is a slightly condensed version of my interview with Stone from earlier in the week. He is a fascinating figure, incredibly bright, incredibly articulate, still burning with passion about JFK, about Kennedy's assassination, and a great many things. And while you may not agree with everything he says, I hope you will enjoy this interview. It is part history lesson, part TED talk about the dangers of big government, amongst other things, and part document of the making of both JFK and JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass. I even managed to get a word in edgeways every now and again. Here we go, Oliver Stone, enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on this very special podcast dedicated to JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass by the film's writer and director, Oliver Stone.
Good morning, Chris.
It aired last night in the States on Showtime, obviously coinciding with the anniversary of JFK's assassination. Right. What was that like for you? What's the reaction been so far?
I try to avoid that. my producer says very good, of course, and the people who respond to on Twitter and all that stuff. Yeah, we're getting positive, but of course, you never know. You know what people think. Yeah, it's the worst thing you can do is chase a reaction. You know, it's so far no one has challenged us on the what's in the film. They attack in America anyway. They're attacking me for really ridiculous things. I mean, it's superficial. One person from Rolling Stone said that that it was a Russian disinformation plot, that the concept of the CIA working against de Gaulle in France, which is actually the story put out by the CIA back then. And there's, and the guy is still unearthing that and using that against the film. Our sources are Chicago Tribune, among others, but that's the American sources. There's a lot of French sources that wrote about this. André Malraux, who was the Minister of Culture, knew about it. People inside the de Gaulle, that was a big deal in France, that there was a coup d'etat that was declared by this general in Algeria. And he lost his credibility after a few days, but it was a real battle at one point. And de Gaulle was really threatened. This is before the attempted assassinations. This was the a coup d'etat attempt. And Dulles had his fingers around it. And then Dulles had a long relationship with de Gaulle, didn't like him. And as we know, had supported the fascist general in World War II, the French fascist general. We're getting off on the wrong point here. But Dulles was very fascist as a character.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had read that piece in Rolling Stone. I read it today, and I was certainly surprised by it. One of the chief things it seems to be saying is that you're not presenting an alternative point of view in the movie.
I've always been accused of that, but you know, they presented their point of view so often and so much and in such volume that whatever space we can get, we have to present our point of view.
Is that something that inspired you to return to the subject?
In 2013, at the 60th anniversary of his death, all the networks in America were presenting this Warren Commission bullshit as holy writ. There was no alternative solutions given. They interviewed me, Tom Brokaw, big shot from NBC, interviewed me for an hour plus, and I gave him the works. I was very good, I thought. Cut it down to 50 seconds a minute, and what I was saying was superficial. So, you know, you can't get out there. You can't get out there. You have to deal with this dirty pool. You know, it's part of the big lie that continues on this case. It's a big lie. Kennedy killing was never satisfying to the American public. All the major intellectuals, people who knew better, were talking about this very early, as early as 64, 5, 6, and 7. Those were the years when this stuff was really coming. There was a revolt of the minds against the nonsense of the Warren Commission. And then after it's true the Garrison trial did put it all back, it did fall back into oblivion because Jim did not succeed. And of course, he was ridiculed beyond belief. And that it went into this oblivion. But the truth was that he had unearthed many interesting things in his losing cause. And that's what we tried to resurrect when we made the movie. He'd written two good books, and we based it on that. Anyway, the movie was a success, as you know, and that led to a huge amount of desire for reinvestigation. And that led to an act of Congress, which is very rare, creating a records review board to declassify and do limited investigation again into this murder. And that led to a lot of documentation, actually, that was released, something like 60,000 documents. Unfortunately, the media did not cover it. It was too detailed. It was too obscure to them. They were another generation of journalists, and it got lost. So before I die, I figured with my Rob Wilson, my co-producer, and Jim DiEugenio, who's a wonderfully great memory, assassination researcher. I suppose you'd call him third generation. But he's been working at this. He remembers everything he's ever read. He's quite an amazing mind. And we've been able to put together this film as a record, as a legacy piece, just to remind people that this thing did happen and in time, and that there is a record of all this malfeasance. I'm proud of it. You know, I realize it's not a film. It's a documentary. And I know that there's limitations there. And it hasn't been run in any, it wasn't financed by anybody in America. It was financed by an English company, Ingenious, thank God for them. Very innovative company. And it was not distributed in America. We went to the Cannes Festival and we had wonderful, sold 10 countries, wonderful reception. We went to the Deauville Festival. We went to the Rome Festival. Always good results, but nothing in America. No publicity at all, hardly. And we've gotten alternative publicity and not really much in the mainstream, anything really. Maybe you, if you consider Rolling Stone mainstream, I guess that's the only thing we've ever gotten there. But it's a case that people want to turn, it's a memory hole, basically.
Yeah.
People want to forget. And I understand that. They don't want to. They say, what does Kennedy have to do with what's going on today? Well, you have to have a sense of history to understand that. Because unless you can understand the past, you're going to be confused about the present. And it's obvious to any historian.
The documentary both it begins and ends with footage of Kennedy. And there's a sense it runs through not just a documentary, but through JFK. Even though that's not about JFK, but there's a sense that you're lamenting his loss and still are lamenting his loss. And there's a sense of what might have been had he lived.
Yeah. You know, you could call me a nostalgia buff or something like that. But, you know, I'm old enough to recognize all the signs that are wrong from World War II on. America's taken a stranger and stranger course. And you have to realize, and look at the big scope of history here. Kennedy comes along, he's a young man. He relates to the old liberalism of that time, which was the Franklin Roosevelt administration, four terms. That was quite something. And the Republicans, the conservatives in our country never recovered from that. They hated him so much that they feared Kennedy for the exact same reasons. Kennedy was a shaker-upper. He was of the rich class, but he wasn't representing the rich class. He was going against the rich class. He was taking on business. And above all, he was taking on the Cold War. He was also taking on civil rights. That's another issue. But he was taking on the Cold War, and that was a huge issue because it was financially lucrative to the conservative, to the Republicans, to keep this Cold War going. I've always maintained, many people have maintained, that the Cold War was hype. It was hype from the beginning. The Soviets were dead in the water. They were completely exhausted from the war and broke, and they needed money. Roosevelt had promised them money, and then Truman suspended it in midshipment. It was just dirty pool. And the moment Roosevelt died in April of 45, the whole thing changed. The whole thing changed. And we go into depth on that on the Untold History of the United States. You have to see that to understand the context of this. And when you do, you'll understand that the country went very right, to the right in 45. And then it continued on with Eisenhower through the buildup of the military-industrial complex. The reason being that they were so scared of another depression, you know, that if we build up our military economy by militarizing it, just like Mr. Hitler did in Germany, it will work in this country. And it did to a certain degree. It doesn't work long-term. So they built up an American economy that was militarized. And by 1960, it had reached a peak of madness, it seems, because the military people, the generals, the Pentagon, were ready. They had so much more weapon. We had so much more weaponry than the Soviets. We were scared of the Soviets. They were going to come up and try to backswipe us. Hmm. And Kennedy ran as a Cold Warrior. It's true. He had to. He couldn't get elected otherwise. But the moment he got into office, to his credit, he sent McNamara over to the Defense Department, and he tried to find out, is there really a missile gap? And he found out, McNamara said, no, we're way ahead in missile superiority. You know, every way we're way ahead. So it was a lie. It was the whole Cold War is built on this lie that the Russians are always catching up to us and about to overcome us, and we have to spend 10 times more money than they do. Our budget's 20 times bigger than theirs, almost 20 times bigger than theirs. We have to spend all this money to prepare for war. Preparing for war is much more lucrative than going to war. It's work because when Kennedy died, no American president since him, not one, and you can name any instance of it, not one has taken on the military industrial, has taken on intelligence agencies. No president has cut their power, cut their budgets like Kennedy did or tried to. Mm. And since then, there is a warning given to that those two sectors of the American government were off limits. You couldn't go there.
You have it in the documentary. You talk about that quote where Kennedy said he would smash the CIA into a million pieces, and you even you show the impact he had and would have had on the CIA going forward.
Significant cuts. He got rid of the top three people, and he was planning to make those budget cuts. They were going to take a lot of that agency down by at least 20%. But he didn't clean the house because all the loyalists to Dulles were left. And then by that, I mean, we have to include Richard Helms becomes a number two man right away to McCone, who's the political appointee. Kennedy, Helms runs the agency. He knows where all the secrets are. The bones are buried. And he's a big Dulles man and a big coal warrior. Hates the communists. Thinks they're a threat to his life. And is going anything possible to destroy them or beat them. But it becomes this Wall Street. These Wall Street people, and a lot of them came from Wall Street, were terrified of communism as it started in 1917. Always have been. Mm. And have maintained a hostile, you know, in America, when the communist revolution happened, there was, what, 10, 11 armies that went into Russia to destroy the revolution. Poland was a leading aggressor. England sent troops. And England was very hostile to communism, and the United States was also, but they sent troops also. Wilson sent troops. There's a whole history of this thing, but this thing never went away. Roosevelt was the first one who recognized the Russian revolution, who recognized the regime. The Soviet Union was recognized diplomatically. So when Kennedy makes all these references to Roosevelt, and he makes these references to what Russia suffered in World War II, pointing out the casualties, he's doing a service to us. And his peace speech, he's telling us, we don't have this enemy. They have done as much to end World War II as anybody did. They actually won World War II, you could say. And Kennedy wants to have an era of peace, cooperation, not a Pax Americana. He says it very clearly, not a Pax Americana enforced by American weapons of war.
Have you ever allowed yourself to think about what might have happened had he lived, what he would have done?
Yeah, sure. There would have been no Vietnam War for sure, because he was clearly, from what we are, and we show this in the film, there's new declassifications, but it shows clearly that I wasn't crazy back in 91 when I said that he had no intention of going into Vietnam. He was withdrawing troops already. He made the first gesture, couldn't do more in the first term. If he'd gotten that second term, he said so himself, a lot of changes were going to happen. Among them, there'd be no Vietnam War. He wouldn't go into Cuba. So why should he go into Vietnam was his logic. I mean, that's 6,000 miles away. So he wouldn't go into Cuba, and that was a big thing. That was his real violation in terms of the people who hated him. He was considered a traitor. He was considered chicken, soft on communism. And you hear that you sense that echo in the film, that people really disliked him, and there was a lot, felt he was a coward, soft.
And from a filmmaker,
by the way, he had a valiant war record. He'd been to war, and that was the thing. He didn't respect the generals because some of them he knew were pompous. He knew that he didn't trust the generals. He had to see it with his own eyes. And I think to a certain degree, that's a sane policy. The problem we have now is all the generals. We have so many generals in our country with all their fruit salads on their chest that NATO and all this. No congressman is able to even challenge the military to say, who are you guys? This is the Wizard of Oz time.
Absolutely. I can see why you feel a kinship with him, having both been to war, having seen the horrors of war.
What I saw was a complete military fuck up. The bureaucracy in Vietnam was insane. They did everything possible to lose the war. It was the biggest scandal, money scandal. And I imagine it's the same thing was true in Iran, Iraq, and in Afghanistan. I mean, they're more concerned about shipping PXs out to these places and taking care of the troops than they are in getting anything done. It's really, America fights wars the same way it builds bureaucracies. It builds cities into these countries. You send Las Vegas over to Vietnam or to Iraq, and you think that's going to solve the problem. It's not going to.
From a filmmaking point of view, Oliver, I wanted to talk about how you approach this. I wanted to ask about how you approached this documentary. As someone who I adore JFK, and I think that the Mr. X sequence is one of the great expository sequences in cinema. Did you? And this is not quite a two-hour version of that, but it certainly does take some of that style and extrapolate it over 2 hours. Was that where you began?
Not really, no. But it's nice for you to think so. It's just It was, no, we approached it conventionally. We had a first team of editors that went into it, and we made a four-hour version. And frankly, it was too detailed, too specific. The four-hour version was not, we couldn't sell it. So we backed away. It couldn't sell it in America.
Wow.
And we felt, you know, it was, I liked it, but it was wonky, what they call wonk material. So we went back, and a new editor, a new team approached it. And we did a two-hour version, which is the one that is in theatrical right now. But we are going to release the four-hour in the United States, and it's in England, or pretty soon it's going to be in England. You know, the four-hour will get out there. And I think it's just a little more detail, and even more detail. And some of the stories are pretty sad. But anyway, there's two versions. And we approached it like a documentary. I was really involved in, you know, I tried to... we were working on it, just like a documentary. I can't say, just keep the interest going, keep the information flowing, keep it so that it's easy on the mind to understand. Now, that's always an issue. Some people say, this is even too thick with information. You can imagine what the 4 hour was like. And the problem is, of course, people don't remember a lot of these things who are younger people, so you have to reach a younger audience.
And were you thinking entirely of reaching a new audience with this, or were you allowing for the fact that people who saw JFK and loved JFK would be watching this as well?
Sure. I mean, it's a big audience in terms of worldwide, because there is a devoted audience to that, but there is a whole new younger generation that don't know. It's a problem that you have, but I hope, you know, of course, Warner Brothers doesn't really do much with the original film. They don't re-release it and stuff like that. So there's not much help there, because it's a new regime at Warner Brothers too. Everyone's scared of the film to a certain degree, because it's, what does it say? There was a coup d'etat in the United States in 1963. The country is not the same since then. And democracy, of course, it's in name only. So, you know, it's a scary thing for these companies, these giant companies now to get involved. So they back away. They'd rather not raise. That's the problem with our world. They'd rather not raise things that disturb people about the American empire. Great. That's taboo still. You can criticize America for all the Netflix documentaries and this and that. You can criticize it on social levels, but you can't go after its essence, its military essence, and it's intelligence agencies. That's where the real soul of this thing lies. So there's no challenge to it. And filmmakers have to go along. We've been kind of bullied, you know. There's no, what filmmakers are attacking any of this stuff? Maybe McKay, he's one of them, and made fun of it well and with Vice, but I haven't seen much. There was another film, about Mauritania, with Jodie Foster. Film was very good, I thought. The Mauritanian.
Yes.
But that really got to it. And there's been a few, but they're attacking the war on terror.
After JFK comes out in a tail end of 91, we're almost at the 30th anniversary. It does incredibly well. It has 8 Oscar nominations, wins a couple. I think it was the 6th highest grossing movie of that year. Did you feel at that time, did you get blowback after the fact?
Oh, yeah.
Or was it the fact that it was so successful that inured you in a way for a while?
Well, in a way, it screwed up my career. I'm not complaining, because I was very proud of the film and happy that it did so well. I was disappointed with the Oscars. Obviously, it was too controversial, and there was a lot of attacks at the last minute from Washington figures, and even Jack Valeni, who was the head of the Motion Picture Board, attacked the film because he'd worked for Lyndon Johnson, you know? So it was, like, very difficult to get, especially around Oscar voting time, all these advertisements started to appear. It was very difficult for me. It was painful. I had been a filmmaker. My habit was to make a film and then write another one, or continue editing, but work on the next one. But I was unable to, because for 6 months after this film came out, not only that, 6 months before the film came out, there was huge attacks in the Washington Post and other publications were picking up the drumbeat that this is a lie. This is going to be more nonsense. It was very bad. And then we had to get our own PR campaign to fight back. And the Warner Brothers management was very bold, and they were strong, Terry Semel and Bob Daley, and they actually backed the film all the way down to the Oscars. But we only won 2 Oscars for editing and cinematography, I believe. And it was disappointing. And of course, over time, there's been not much support. It's a 3-hour, 10-minute movie. It did run and it's been successful, but over time, the big TV outlets, you know, they don't play it that much. So it will be forgotten, but there's always hope that it can be remembered, you know. It's a special film, but my career didn't, from that moment on, I would be judged really as a political filmmaker. Although I made other types of films, I was judged in another way. I always felt that. And I don't think it was helpful to my career, actually, although I'm very proud of it. But it's a different kind of specialty. Like, I became more of a specialty.
Mm. It's interesting because obviously you went perhaps not straight into Heaven and Earth, but that...
Not straight, no. I lost a year. I doing all these, defending the film, going everywhere, selling it abroad. And here, when Heaven and Earth came out about two years later, it was not very well received, although I still love that film. It's about a Vietnamese woman, villager, and her travails on the Vietnam War, Americans and Viet Cong. She goes back and forth. Interesting film.
Yeah. So the reaction, the reception to JFK didn't, it was a slow burn in terms of its impact on your career.
Critics were mixed, yes, but some of them were very good and really pushed it. But the usual institutions, no, they were tough on it.
But it has an immediate impact, Oliver. I mean, it contributed to the loosening of the cord around all those classified documents.
As a result, they blame me on the QAnon conspiracy. They think that it's the mother of many conspiracies. But it did loosen the thinking of people. And, the government is not to be trusted. You have to question your government because they're not always telling you the truth. Their national interests sometimes differ. In America's case, it differs radically from what the people want. People don't want war. They don't want this big military. They want to be defended. They want a strong defense. But if you get down to the specifics and you run polls about what people want, the people feel one way and the government does one thing. It's just impossible to get the two. So the divergence has grown over time. And here we are now in this new era since Donald Trump and all that stuff. Actually, I blame more George W. Bush than I blame Trump because W. Bush put us on a path when he wasn't even elected. he put us on a path of an endless war with the war on terror.
Of course, you've tackled W quite famously. And do you think that's it as far as you're concerned in terms of your unofficial trilogy of American president
probably,
movies?
Probably, yes. Considering my age and energy required, yeah. It's I've done a lot in there. W was not as well received as I'd hoped. I'm very happy about Nixon, but again, that was also ignored. Nixon is an interesting film, but well worth seeing still today because of it's a character portrait by Hopkins, and that's amazing. And it's a real feeling of Nixon, which I really was proud of. But making political films is tough. And W also didn't do as well as we'd hoped. So I don't think it's in the cards.
Okay. Because Nixon and JFK share a certain DNA in that they're both incredibly dense epics. You fit so much information into those movies. And JFK, I think, was a bit of a revolutionary film. It's a hugely influential movie. I think it's had an enormous impact on filmmakers in terms of the visual grammar and the way the film is edited. JFK Revisited does the same thing. It has a lot of information. As you say, it packs a lot into 2 hours. Can you talk about your approach to that? Was that something that, going back to the original JFK movie and this, that you almost had to reinvent the wheel in order to cram all that exposition and in order to cram all that information into a movie?
I had to reinvent the wheel. We had to reinvent the wheel with the original because we did. It was insane. And we were putting so much information. And it was important because I felt maybe overly defensively that I had to put more information to protect this thesis. So I think I overdid it. I mean, if I look at the film now, I probably would cut some of that material. I don't think it's necessary. I think you made the point.
What would you cut?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff that is just, you could cut it and it wouldn't change the impact of the film. Hmm. But I was faced with being on the defensive, in a sense. We got attacked 6 months before we released the film for misinformation, for this and that. You know, you become defensive. It makes you defensive. You're paranoid. We had our script stolen. I mean, there were so many things that happened, you know, that I'd have to write about it, frankly, because I have to remember all the stuff that happened. It was traumatic to me because I wasn't used to it. I had never been in a public forum like that. The documentary is different because it was, the information was there. It was a question of Di Eugenio. He wrote it. I didn't write this. The writing of it is just factual. We're just laying out facts. How we put them in a certain order, that is an editing decision. So it's a different feeling for me than the original. That was an original experience. The documentary is, I'm proud of it, but it's not this. It's not making it. You have to, you can't play the tricks you did as in a feature film. You have to stay straight and narrow, you know, basically. And you have to be very accurate.
You've got some very interesting elements in the documentary, one of which is the use of multiple narrators, which I was very, very intrigued by. You're in the documentary as well, so you're a narrator. Whoopi Goldberg narrates, and then Donald Sutherland, which is a wonderful link, a wonderful bridge to the movie, JFK, comes in at the end. Can you talk about that approach, where that came from?
Well, it was... Donald was not in the best of health, frankly.
Oh, bless
him. So, and his voice is weaker. So I think sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. And Whoopi has a different vernacular, which I love. So she's talking about a lot of the basic stuff from the Warren Commission. And she does it in a very broad accent, her way of talking. It makes it sure that you're listening. It makes it clear. She's very clear. Where Donald goes into the foreign affairs and what he was doing abroad, his legacy, the thing, why was Kennedy killed? That's a different subject matter than all the facts of the assassination. So we said, we'll have Donald do that because that's what he did in the original. The why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? What was the result? And there's a lot more of that in the 4 hour of Donald, which I hope you see. But basically, it's robbery. The why is the most important issue here. It's not who, how, because we can't get all the facts. We can't get all the details correct. We don't really know. We do know that there was no three shots. We know there was more than three shots. And we know there was different directions. So that's what we know for sure from just looking at the Zapruder film and other things. But when you get into the corruption of the autopsy, man, it's maddening. When you get this military autopsy being done by these hacks, and they break every rule of medical science in order to come up with this. Same thing is true with a bullet. They break every rule of gravity, every rule of physics in order to say that there's three shots, in this car. It's just impossible. That should disturb anybody.
In terms of going back to JFK, the original movie, recruiting this incredible cast, did you have conversations with this all-star cast? You had, you know, Kevin Costner and Sissy Spacek, Jack Lemmon. Did you have conversations with them about what they believed about JFK's assassination? Did you almost have to convince people to come on board?
Not always, no. With Kevin, yes, he was cautious. He was very cautious, and I don't blame him. He didn't know much about it, and we gave him as much as we could. We gave him information. He went down to New Orleans. He wanted to meet Garrison, which he did, and he met several of the other people around the assassination. So, and his wife played a large role in getting him into this film to take a chance, because he would come off, I think it was Robin Hood. So it was a big step for him, and he was nervous, but he was a yeoman. He did his job. He carries the film. He's an anchor through the whole film. And it was intimidating for him, I have to say, but he did a good job. And the other actors, maybe a couple were into it, but I think most of them accepted. They knew Jack Lemmon had been around a long time. He lived through these events, so he had no qualms about it. He felt something had happened there.
Ed Asner, for example.
Ed Asner was devoted. Yeah, he was devoted to the cause. But I had him play a conservative, a pugnacious conservative.
Very much so. And I just want to finish off by asking you about that sequence, the Mr. X sequence that I mentioned earlier on, because it's astonishing. It's 14 minutes. It's a monologue. It's got so much dense information, exposition. Donald Sutherland is amazing in that. And what's fascinating about it as well is that Costner basically just listens. It's very rare, very, very rare for a leading man to do that. What are your memories of crafting that sequence?
I'm aware of that. And you know, as a screenwriter, I was a little bit, I was saying, you know, I have to have more repartee. But it's when I first heard this from Fletcher Prouty, who was a colonel in the Air Force, who was a focus point officer between the CIA and the Air Force. He was the guy who provided the hardware to the CIA for these operations in Tibet, wherever they needed it in Ukraine. They'd been using hardware. They needed military help. You understand, it's a paramilitary deal. So when I heard it from Prouty, I was that kind of stunned. It was much bigger. Now, Garrison has it in his book, but he'd spoken to Prouty, and people like Prouty. So he had a vision of this thing, and I think it was a correct vision. But Prouty put in all the details because he knew all the characters. He knew Dulles. He knew all these people from World War II. He'd been an officer in the Air Force then, so he'd been around, and he knew the change in the Pentagon. He said after 63, after that moment, the Pentagon was different. It was just a new kind of resignation of a despair, given the whole country sagged. Prouty, listen, Sutherland, I'm very lucky because I went to Brando and I made a mistake because I realized, I'm glad Marlon passed because he never would have gotten through this thing alive. I mean, it would have been a 25-minute scene at least. And it wouldn't have happened. And he was smart, and smarter than I was. And I was very lucky to stumble onto Donald because he talks fast. He's a Canadian, very bright, gets it. And spits it out. And he understood that he'd done a lot of films. He knew that films required this kind of pace in order for the audience to keep up. And he does it at the right speed. In other words, you may not understand everything, but you hear it, you get the mood. And that was the only way to solve this problem. Otherwise, I would have had to cut. In fact, the original screenplay, the Mr. X character appears twice in the middle of the film to give it that bump up. And at the end to conclude, we didn't need a conclusion. So after what we went through, so we moved the end to the middle. And if you look closely in the film, there are clothing changes in Donald Sutherland's character and Kevin Costner's character, but you won't notice it the way it's cut. So we're very lucky to have Donald do this, yeah.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Oliver, I could talk to you about JFK and JFK Revisited all day, but I've got to let you go. It's been an absolute pleasure, sir. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.
Fantastic. Thank you, Oliver. Take care. And that was Oliver Stone. I hope you enjoyed it. As I said earlier, JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass is out now in UK cinemas. The regular Empire podcast, out today, featuring guests John Leguizamo, Adam Driver, and Chloe Zhao, is also out right now for you to listen to. So check it out. If you don't already listen to the Empire podcast, like, subscribe, and leave us a nice 5-star review on iTunes if you feel so inclined. And if you don't, hey-ho. You know what? Let's just forget that I even asked. Anyway, on that note, I am off to sit on a park bench and wait for a man in a hat to come and tell me about the secrets of the universe. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.